two, three. All right, everyone, it's the Grim Lord here, and I'm back with another video. This is the Grim Articles Show, and I'm not doing this with alcohol because it is, like, morning for me, guys. Like, I just woke up. I'm not the guy that has a drink when he first gets up. I'm not that guy. But, should I go back to days? I'll probably bring the alcohol back, but for now, it's just gonna sit there. Look, I'm not gonna get drunk when I first get up, man. It's not a good thing. Plus, I got a lot of shit to do tonight. Alright, so, before we even start, let's talk about our sponsor. That's www.spinningrobotpussy.com. You can go ahead and get yourself one of those. They're almost off pre-order, and I'm pretty sure that you're gonna be able to get yours in the fall, I think. That's not too long, so definitely look forward to that. They could revolutionize the sex toy game, I guess you could say. You know, the women have all the vibrators, and they have all these Sibian little dicks on a piston. And I was looking at shit from Cam Soda, where this woman, she just had this, like, it was like 10 times the size of my dick, and it was like just on a piston, and it just going in and out. I'm like, holy crap. It's like, why do women even need men for sex at all when you got shit like this? So I was like, okay, men need to kind of have their own thing, you know? So we're not, you know, it stops the simping of the women, because obviously, like Drexel says, a lot of the guys just want the pee sleeve. Well, if you get a pee sleeve experience that is actually better and feels better than the real deal, you may not be willing to simp. Obviously, there's other things that women can bring to the table as far as emotional what we could say is like manipulation. That sort of thing, the girlfriend experience, if you will, and it can't do that, okay? It can't do that, but it can really make you feel good and give you that necessary post-nut clarity that you might want from some of your sexual encounters that you may not be getting from random thoughts. So yeah, check that out at www.spinningrobotpussy.com. I'm going to read that a little slower this time. Anyway, let's start with our first article. This is actually an older one, but I didn't want to forget it because nobody else has really been talking about it. And I think I might be one of the only guys in the manosphere that's mentioned it. It says, advertising sector has Me Too moment as blog sparks women's anger. Campaigner Zoe Scammon, wow, her name is literally Scammon, has collected women's stories and is calling for policy change in the industry. Hundreds of women working in advertising have described being sexually assaulted, harassed, and discriminated against after a blog provoked an outpouring of fury that is being described as the industry's Me Too moment. Senior advertising industry player Zoe Scammon said she has been inundated with emails from across the world describing incidents ranging from sexist comments in meetings to sexual assault and rape. She is now working with leaders of bodies representing women in the advertising sector to try to effect real change and not just another policy pledge. In her blog post, Mad Men, Furious Women, Scammon includes some of the examples she received but has removed identifying details. Scammon described being sexually assaulted by an ad industry boss when she was 24 after he followed her into a toilet cubicle on a night out, suggesting later that they forget about it, though it was consensual or mutual, it was neither, she wrote. Another woman found out she was being paid $30,000 less than a man of equivalent seniority and experience, while one email described the director being made redundant when 6 months pregnant after just bringing in new business. Stories of receiving sexual advances for clients were common, with a woman describing being told to take one for the team and suck it up. While the vast majority of women who had contacted her were angry, many did not want their stories posted online, Scammon said. Women are absolutely terrified of the consequences of them being honest about the abuse that they face, she said. These women get pushed out, they get silenced with NDAs, and the men who are problematic continue to succeed, continue to lead these agencies. All of us have got personal stories of women who have had to speak up and who have just been absolutely trash. Scammon, founder of marketing and advertising agency Bodacious, said she had written the blog after meeting up with another female strategist, of course, who had just moved to London. They were soon talking about who to avoid in the industry and which would be the safer agencies. Between the two of us, we had some horrific stories, she said, and those aren't from back in the 80s and 90s, they're happening now. She believes that there's misogyny and discrimination in every field of work. The self-styled maverick nature of advertising makes a particularly difficult and sometimes dangerous place for women. The problem with supposedly living outside of society's roles is you get away with bad behavior and is dismissed as just what happens in advertising, she said. In a 2018 study by Time 2, the ad industry body set up in the wake of Me Too, found that 41% of respondents had experienced sexual harassment and assault at work, but 83% had not reported it. In a 2016 survey of 600 women in the U.S. from the 3% conference, found that more than half of the respondents had been subjected to an unwanted sexual advance. 88% of those from a colleague, 70% from a superior, and 49% from a client. Only 1 in 3 had filed a complaint. The same report also found that 68% of women in the sector had been told they were too aggressive. Wow. Well, I mean, that's true sometimes. And then 64, they were too emotional. That's also true. Look, I'm sorry if you don't want to fucking face facts, but women can be more aggressive and emotional because they get really hardcore in their feelings and hormones and shit. It happens. I work with a lot of women. I can tell you how that is. Scammon has joined up with leaders from different bodies representing women in advertising, and she said there is now a coming together to talk about real change. She would like to see the end of NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, and cases of sexual harassment and assault in the industry, and the creation of a central repository, an external body where harassment could be externally and independently reported and investigated. When this stuff happens in agencies, the only route of escalation for women is to an employer's human resources department. But we all know that HR is not on your side. They're there to silence staff and avoid scandals, she said. It would put the fear of God into the agencies if they knew that there was an unbiased third party that women could go to and that they couldn't control. That sounds really fucking dangerous, folks. If there was a third party that was totally biased, by the way, totally biased because they're particularly dealing with women. Anything a woman says, whether it happened or not, could be taken as gospel. And then you're completely fucked and you lose your job. You said she was this. Like, no, this woman was harassing me. No, we have testimony from her that you were harassing her. And like, that's fucking preposterous. I wasn't harassing her. I was telling her to leave me alone. I was trying to do my job. You know, that's really scary, fellas. It's not a good thing at all. Scammon asked that if advertising agencies are serious about tackling the problem, they should pay to find such a body rather than making an easily forgotten pledge. I don't give a shit about pledges and codes of conduct because they don't mean anything. They don't work. What I really want to see is policy change. Well, again, it's just going to be dangerous, and it seems that they're just trying to get a one-up on men. I mean, whether it happened or not. I mean, there's situations where, yeah, it does happen, but it depends. If she's like the Chad guy and she thinks he's really attractive, he'll get by with saying things like that and she'll laugh it off. But if it's, you know, Fat Finster or something and he says, "Oh, you look really nice today, miss. Oh my God, you creep, you're harassing me." You know, that's what we're talking about right now. And that is really bad. Because, you know, maybe Fat Finster doesn't do well with the ladies, but maybe he's good at his fucking job, you know? Maybe Fat Finster is the guy that keeps the fucking servers from melting down, or make sure that the infrastructure is, you know, the way it's supposed to be, because he's just a nerdy guy that knows his shit, and what you need him. And it, maybe he says some stupid little simpy comments because, I don't know, some guys, they're just stuck on simping and there's really nothing you can do about it. But it's just a bad situation, folks. Okay, now to some more interesting stuff. We've got, let's see, there we go. We've got SciTech Daily. This came out a while ago, but it's kind of interesting. Scientists discover that mating can cause epigenetic changes that last for 300 generations. And this is by the University of Maryland. University of Maryland scientists discover that match matters. The right combination of parents and nematode worms. Now keep in mind, this is just nematode worms. Can turn a gene off indefinitely. Evidence suggests that what happens in one generation, diet, toxin exposure, trauma, and fear, can have lasting effects on future generations. Scientists believe these effects result from epigenetic changes that occur in response to the environment and turn genes on or off without altering the genome or DNA sequence. But how these changes are passed down through generations has not been understood, in part because scientists have not had a simple way to study the phenomenon. A new study by researchers at the University of Maryland provides a potential tool for unraveling the mystery of how experiences can cause inevitable inheritable changes to an animal's biology. By mating nematode worms, they produce permanent epigenetic changes that lasted for more than 300 generations. The research was published on July 9th in the journal Nature Communications. There's a lot of interest in heritable epigenetics, said Anthony Jose, Associate Professor of Cell Biology and Molecular Genetics at UMD and senior author of the study. But getting clear answers is difficult. For instance, if I'm on some diet today, how does that affect my children and grandchildren and so on? No one knows because so many different variables are involved. But we've found this very simple method through mating to turn off a single gene for multiple generations. And that gives us a huge opportunity to study how these stable epigenetic changes occur. In the new study, Jose and his team found while breeding nematode worms that some matings lead to epigenetic changes in offspring that continue to be passed down through as many generations as the scientists continue to breed them. This discovery will enable scientists to explore how epigenetic changes are passed to future generations and what characteristics make genes susceptible to permanent epigenetic changes. Jose and his team began this work in 2013 while working with nematode worms, I'm not going to say the name of that specimen, a species often used as a model for understanding animal biology. The scientists noted that while worms breed to carry a gene they called T, which produces fluorescent proteins, sometimes glowed and sometimes didn't. This was puzzling because the glowers and non-glowers had identical DNA. Everything began when we stumbled upon a rare gene that underwent permanent change for hundreds of generations just by mating. We could have easily missed it, said that guy, you know, scientist guy. He's an Indian dude. A co-lead author of the study, who is now a postdoctoral fellow at Columbia University. To understand the phenomenon better, the researchers conducted breeding experiments in which only the mother or father carried the fluorescent gene. The team expected that no matter which parent carried the gene, the offspring would glow. Instead, they found that when the mother carried the gene, the offspring always glowed, meaning the gene was always turned on. But when the father carried the gene, the offspring usually weakly glowed or did not glow at all. We found that this RNA-based signals controlling gene, We found that there are these RNA-based signals controlling gene expression, Jose said. Some of these signals silence the gene, and some of them are protective signals that prevent silencing. These signals are duking it out as the offspring developed. When the gene comes from the mother, the protective signal always wins. But when the gene comes from the father, the silencing signal always wins. When the silencing signal wins, the gene is silenced for good, or for at least 300 generations, which is how long Jose and his colleagues followed their laboratory-bred worms. Previous examples of epigenetic changes were more complex or they did not last more than a couple of generations. The researchers don't yet know why the silencing signal only wins some of the time, but this new finding puts them in a much better position to explore the details of epigenetic inheritance than ever before. While we found a set of genes that can be silenced almost permanently, most other genes are not affected the same way, said the study's other co-lead author, who is now a postdoctoral fellow at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. After silencing, they bounce back and become expressed in future generations. Okay, that's kind of interesting. With the new findings, the researchers now believe some genes could be vulnerable to permanent epigenetic change while other genes recover within a few generations. Although studies in worms are not the same as studies in humans, the research provides a window into biological processes that are likely shared at least in part by all animals. The two big advantages we have now from this work are that this long-lasting epigenetic change is easy to induce through mating, and that it occurs at the level of a single gene, Jose said. Now we can manipulate this gene and control everything about it, which will allow us to determine what characteristics make a gene susceptible or resistant to heritable epigenetic change. Jose and his colleagues expect that future studies may one day help scientists identify human genes that are vulnerable to long-lasting epigenetic changes. It's interesting that they did this on nematodes, because if you've played Resident Evil Village, and this is kind of a spoiler, the Kadal was made through nematodes. They basically took a nematode and they injected a parasite into the nematode, which created the Kadal. And that's what created the thing that basically turn people into monsters or whatever else, but it was all done through a nematode. So that's some interesting shit. But it is really kind of cool that the mother's genes can be really influential to the offspring. Like, really influential. And the father's genes might not, but the father can, like, turn it off, and the mother can turn it on. That kind of makes sense, because, like, if a mother tells a child to turn something off and they don't do it, it might not go anywhere. But if the father says, "I thought your mother told you to go in there and turn that off," then that might mean the child listens and turns it off. So, just saying. Here's another one I wanted to discuss and couldn't really talk about before. This happened on, this is kind of old. Hold on. Well, I'm going to go through it anyway, because it was just recently posted again. It was originally done on 2018, but it's the genius neuroscientist who might hold the key to true AI. Carl Friston's free energy principle might be the most all-encompassing idea since Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection. But to understand it, you need to peer inside the mind of Friston himself. When King George III of England began to show signs of acute mania towards the end of his reign, rumors about the royal madness multiplied quickly in the public mind. One legend had it that George tried to shake hands with a tree, believing it to be the King of Prussia. Wow. Another described how he was whisked away to a house on Queen Square in the Bloomsbury district of London to receive treatment among his treatments. The tale goes on that George's wife, Queen Charlotte, hired out the cellar of a local pub to stock provisions for the king's meals while he stayed under his doctor's care. More than two centuries later, this story about Queen Square is still popular in London guidebooks. And whether or not it's true, the neighborhood has evolved over the years as to conform to it. A metal statue of Charlotte stands over the northern end of the square. The corner pub is called the Queen's Larder, and the square's quiet rectangular garden is now all but surrounded by people who work on brains, and people's brains need work. The National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery, where the modern-day royal might seek treatment, dominates one corner of Queen Square, and the world-renowned neuroscience research facilities of University College London round out its perimeter. During a week of perfect weather last July, dozens of neurological patients and their families passed silent time on wooden benches at the outer edges of the grass. On a typical Monday, Carl Friston arrives on Queen Square at 12:25 p.m. and smokes a cigarette in the garden by the statue of Queen Charlotte. A slightly bent, solitary figure with thick gray hair, Friston is the scientific director of University College London's storied Functional Imaging Laboratory, known to everyone else who works there as FIL. After finishing his cigarette, Friston walks to the western side of the square, enters a brick and limestone building, and heads to a seminar room on the fourth floor where anyone from two or two dozen people might be facing a blank wall while waiting for him. Friston likes to arrive 5 minutes late, so everyone else is already there. Fear not the robot singularity. His greeting to the group is liable to be his first substantial utterance of the day, as Friston prefers not to speak with other human beings before noon. At home, he will have conversed with his wife and three sons via an agreed-upon series of smiles and grunts. He also rarely meets people one-on-one. He prefers to hold open meetings like this one, where students, postdocs, and members of the public who desire Friston's experience, a category of person that has become almost chemically broad in recent years, can seek his knowledge. He believes that if one person has an idea or a question of a project going on, the best way to learn about it is for the whole group to come together, hear the person, and then everybody gets a chance to ask questions and discuss. And so one person's learning becomes everybody's learning. It's very unique, as many things are with Carl. At the start of each Monday morning, everyone goes around and states their questions at the outset. Friston walks in slow, deliberate circles as he listens, his glasses perched at the end of his nose so that he's always lowering his head to see the person who is speaking. He then spends the next few hours answering the question in turn. A Victorian gentleman with Victorian manners and tastes, as one friend describes Friston, he responds to even the most confused questions with courtesy and rapid reformulation. The Q&A sessions, which I started calling Ask Carl meetings, are remarkable feats of endurance, memory, breadth of knowledge, and creative thinking. They often end when it is time for Friston to retreat the minuscule metal balcony hanging off his office for another smoke. There's a lot of extra shit here that's really not that interesting. But it says, Friston first became a heroic figure in academia for devising many of the most important tools that have made human brains legible to science. In 1990, he invented statistical parametric mapping, a computational technique that helps, as one neuroscientist puts it, squash and squish brain images into a consistent shape so that researchers can do apples-to-apples comparisons of activity within different crania. Statistical parametric mapping came a corollary called voxel-based morphometry, an imaging technique that was used in one famous study to show that the rear side of the hippocampus of London taxi drivers grew as they learned the knowledge. A study published in Science in 2011 used yet a third brain imaging analysis software. For some odd reason, I am stuffed up today. Hold on just a second, folks. I'm actually gonna cut this so I can blow my nose or something. And I'll be right back. Such is what happens when you do a live show. I'll just have to take out this breathe inhaler thing. Oh, woo, much better. Ooh, I do apologize for that, folks. Had to handle that situation. Okay. They said, a study published in Science in 2011 used yet a third brain imaging analysis software invented by Friston, dynamic causal modeling, to determine if people with severe brain damage were minimally conscious or simply vegetative. When Friston was introduced into the Royal Society of Fellows in 2006, the Academy described its impact on studies of the brain as revolutionary, and said that more than 90% of papers published in brain imaging used his methods. 2 years later, the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, a research outfit led by AI pioneer Oren Etzioni, calculated that Friston is the world's most frequently cited neuroscientist. He has an H-index, a measure used to measure the impact of a researcher's publications, nearly twice the size of Albert Einstein's. Last year, Clarivate Analytics, which over more than two decades has successfully predicted 46 Nobel Prize winners in three sciences, ranked Friston among the three most likely winners in the physiology or medicine category. What's remarkable, however, is that few of the researchers who make the pilgrimage to see Friston these days have come to talk about brain imaging at all. Over a 10-day period this summer, Friston advised an astrophysicist, several philosophers, a computer engineer working on a more personable competitor to the Amazon Echo, the head of the artificial intelligence for one of the world's largest insurance companies, a neuroscientist seeking to build better hearing aids, and a psychiatrist with a startup that applies machine learning to help treat depression. And most of them had come because they were desperate to understand something else entirely. For his past decade or so, Friston has devoted much of his time and effort to developing an idea he calls the free energy principle. Friston refers to neuroimaging research as his day job, the way a jazz musician might refer to his shift at the local public library with this idea. Friston believes that he has invented nothing less than the organizing principle of all life, and all intelligence as well. If you are alive, he sets out to answer, what sorts of behaviors must you show? First, the bad news. The free energy principle is maddeningly difficult to understand. So difficult, in fact, that entire rooms of very, very smart people have tried and failed to grasp it. A Twitter account with 3,000 followers exists simply to mock its opacity, and nearly every person I spoke with about it, including researchers whose work depends upon it, told me they didn't fully comprehend it. But often those same people hasten to add that the free energy principle, at its heart, tells a simple story and solves a basic puzzle. The second law of thermodynamics tells us that universe tends towards entropy, towards delusion. Wow. But living things fiercely resist it. We wake up every morning nearly the same person we were the day before, with clear separations between our cells and organs, and between us and the world without. How? Friston's free energy principle says that all life, at every scale of the organization, from single cells to the human brain, with its billions of neurons, is driven by the same universal imperative, which can be reduced to a mathematical function. To be alive, he says, is to enact in the ways that reduce the gulf between your expectations and your sensory inputs. Or, as in Fristonian terms, it is to minimize free energy. Like, this is a very, 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 very long article. I really don't understand, personally, like, this is something that is actually so long. And it's stupidly long. I mean, this is probably about 30 or 40 paragraphs. I'm not even gonna lie. This could be put into a book. Like a small, I don't know, like a light novel or something. And just, like, put Friston on it. Because they are still fucking talking about this. Honestly, go see if somebody has a, like, if somebody's done, like, a Cliff Notes on this or something. Because this is really long. Like, it would take more than the time I have in this show to actually go through it. It is a fascinating piece, though. And you're going to probably want to check it out. It was a Wired article from 2018 on Friston. And again, I appreciate that Wired decided to write a book on this man's life. Like, in there, like, it's just way too long. And, I mean, that's actually kind of a criticism against Wired. If you're going to make, like, an autobiographical thing about this scientist, it's probably not good to post it on social media. Where I'm not saying people don't have high attention, because they don't really have high attention spans. But, it's, I mean, this is like 50 paragraphs on this man. And I was getting winded, like I was running out of air. It was getting hard to breathe. So, yeah, it's just... go check that out on your own. It's a really good article. They talk all about the rules of games and just all. I mean, it's a little older, and I'm sure some YouTuber probably made it a little more condensed, which is what it needed. I like that they have all that information, but again, it's almost like a book. So, yeah, unfortunately, we're not going to cover this entire piece, because I don't have 3 hours to do that. But thank you, Wired, for that information. Alright, here's something interesting. Humans might be making genetic evolution obsolete. Humans now evolve faster than ever, and it's not because of genes. At the mercy of natural selection since the dawn of life, our ancestors adapted, mated, and died, passing on tiny genetic mutations that eventually made humans what we are today. But evolution isn't bound strictly to genes anymore, new study suggests. Instead, human culture may be driving evolution faster than genetic mutations can work. In this conception, evolution no longer requires genetic mutations that confer a survival advantage being passed on and becoming widespread. Instead, learned behaviors passed on through culture are the mutations that provide survival advantages. This so-called cultural evolution may now shape humanity's fate more strongly than natural selection, the researchers argue. When a virus attacks a species, it typically becomes immune to that virus through genetic evolution. Study co-author Zach Wood, a postdoctoral researcher in the School of Biology and Ecology at the University of Maine, told Live Science. Such evolution works slowly, as those who are more susceptible die off and only those who survive pass on their genes. But nowadays, humans mostly don't need to adapt to such threats genetically. Instead, we adapt by developing vaccines and other medical interventions, which are not the results of one person's work, but rather of many people building on the accumulated mutations of cultural knowledge. By developing vaccines, human culture improves its collective immune system, said co-author Tim Waring, an associate professor of social ecological systems modeling at the University of Maine. And sometimes, cultural evolution can lead to genetic evolution. The classic example is lactose tolerance, Waring told Live Science. Drinking cow's milk began as a cultural trait and then drove the genetic evolution of a group of humans. In that case, cultural change preceded genetic change, not the other way around. The concept of cultural evolution began with the father of evolution himself, Waring said. Charles Darwin understood that behaviors could evolve and be passed to offspring just as physical traits are, but scientists in his day believed that changes in behaviors were inherited. For example, if a mother had a trait that inclined her to teach a daughter to forage for food, she would pass on this inherited trait to her daughter. In turn, her daughter might be more likely to survive, and as a result, that trait would become more common in the population. Waring and Wood argue in their new study, published June 2nd in the Journal of Proceedings of the Royal Society B, that at some point in human history, culture began to wrest evolutionary control from our DNA. And now, they say, cultural change is allowing us to evolve in ways biological change alone could not. Here's why. Culture is group-oriented, and people in those groups tend to talk to, learn from, and imitate one another. Let me read that again. People in those groups tend to talk to, learn from, and imitate one another. It's very true. These group behaviors allow people to pass on adaptations they learn through culture faster than genes that can transmit similar survival benefits. An individual can learn skills and information from a nearly unlimited number of people in a small amount of time, and in turn spread that information to many others. And the more people available to learn from, the better. It's a very good example right here in the manosphere. Large groups solve problems faster than smaller groups, and intergroup competition stimulates adaptations that might help those groups survive. As ideas spread, cultures develop new traits. In contrast, a person only inherits genetic information from two parents and racks up relatively few random mutations in their eggs or sperm, which takes about 20 years to be passed on to their small handful of children. That's just as much smaller pace of change. I'm sorry, that's just a much slower pace of change. This theory has been a long time coming, said Paul Smaldino, an associate professor of cognitive and information sciences at the University of California, Mercer, who was not affiliated with this study. People have been working for a long time to describe how evolutionary biology interacts with culture. It's possible, the researcher suggests, that the appearance of a human culture represents a key evolutionary milestone. The big argument is that culture is the next evolutionary transition state, he told Live Science. Throughout the history of life, key transition states have had huge effects on the pace and direction of evolution. The evolution of cells with DNA was a big transitional state, and then when larger cells with organelles and complex internal structures arrived, it changed the game again. Cells coalescing into plants and animals was another big sea change, as was the evolution of sex, the transition to life on land, and so on. Each of these events changed the way evolution acted, and now humans might be in the midst of yet another evolutionary transformation. We might still evolve genetically, but that may not control human survival very much anymore. In very long term, we suggest that humans are evolving from individual genetic organisms to cultural groups which function as superorganisms, similar to ant colonies and beehives. Wow! Now that's kind of interesting, because we talk a lot about that kind of mentality where there's the queen and the workers and, you know, the drones and everything. Well, I don't know. Can we say, like, what? Are some of the big content creators, like, the queen of the hive and the people follow their stuff? They're just, like, the workers? And, like, I don't know, man. But that seems to be what they're saying, like, even as far as the manosphere is concerned. Well, you kind of see that because you see this one person and then you see the followers. Like, again, the queen, and then you have the rest of the hive. So, like, let's take Fresh and Fit, for example, you know, and the more PUA-centric manosphere. Or someone like Donovan Sharp, even. You know, there's a lot of other guys under him that are maybe as influential in their own right, but they're not up to what Donovan Sharp was recognized as. So maybe, and I'm just saying, but maybe he is considered like the big, I don't know, I guess the big queen, and everybody else that follows him is just like the drone and the worker, and they do what he says, you know, because he says, hey, I want you to do this, I want you to do that, I want you to stay away from this, I want you, you know, stuff like that. People pay attention to that. So, like, I'm a smaller content creator, but there's larger content creators that I get information from that are much larger than me. So they would be like the queen at the top of the pot of the manosphere, or the hive, whatever you want to say. But, and again, what they teach me, I teach you guys, or I'm taught myself, and basically it goes from there. Like, you adapt what we teach you, or what I was taught, I adapt, and it just flows like that. We're adapting things that other men have been teaching us, and that is helping us to evolve our way of thinking and our thought patterns. The same could be true of women and the influencers. The influencers tell the women how to behave, and the women adapt in the way that they have, which has been very detrimental. So, yeah, I can see all of this is quite true. Waring said in a statement, but genetics drives bee colonies. Well, we are seeing a lot of eugenic type things going on. While the human superorganism will exist in a category all its own, what that superorganism looks like in the distant future is unclear, but it will likely take a village to figure it out. Very, very interesting. Let's see. That one's not so interesting. I'm trying to go with the ones that are actually good. And that's more of an opinion article. It's not anything I really need to cover. I'm just looking to see if there's anything that's really... I know there's one for sure I'm covering tonight. Okay, this one I'm definitely going to cover, if it's not ungodly long. Let's see. Let's look at it. Well, it's got that continue reading. Oh, Lord. Okay, there's really not much to say here, I guess. New Scientist. Neuroscientists are ignoring the differences between males and females, because of course they are. Top neuroscience research papers are 8 times more likely to only study male participants or samples compared with female-only studies, a review has found. In addition, only 4% of papers look for sex differences in their data, suggesting that neurological disorders in women may be being overlooked. There's quite a few of them, actually. I would have to bet on that. And Lisa Galea, the University of British Columbia, and her colleagues analyzed the sex of samples in every new research paper published by 3 of the world's most respected neuroscience journals. And of course, now they want me to log in. This is the only thing I don't like about these internet articles, because then you have to go right to archive.is, and I'm not even sure if this kind of article has been archived. It might have been. It was a week ago. Unfortunately, even the person who archived it did archive the whole thing. Wow. So we really don't have that one for you, unfortunately. It still has an archived version that says continue reading, subscribe now. So, unfortunately, I can't give you that article. Blame the paygates on some of these. Just know that some woman's researching and found out that a lot of the studies are focusing on men and not women neurobiological disorders. So that's kind of a big thing, I guess. They can be pretty crazy too, and maybe more research does need to be done in that area because they are crazier than we could ever imagine, and we're learning that. Like RPM said, women are more fucked up than we could possibly ever imagine. They're definitely not sugar and spice and everything nice. Now, here's the one I wanted to cover. I have my own theories here, and I will probably negate what they said in my rebuttal of this article. SciTech Daily. Scientists warn of bleak cyborg future from brain-computer interfaces. Boo! Researchers warn of the potential social, ethical, and legal consequences of technologies interacting heavily with human brains. Surpassing the biological limitations of the brain and using one's mind to interact with and control external electronic devices may sound like the distant cyborg future, but it could come sooner than we think. I'm looking forward to that. Researchers from the Imperial College in London conducted a review of modern commercial brain-computer interface devices, BCI, and they discussed the primary technology limitations and humanitarian concerns of these devices in APL Bioengineering from AIP Publishing. The most promising method to achieve real-world BCI applications is through electroencephalography, EEG, a method of monitoring the brain non-invasively through its electrical activity. EEG-based BCIs, or eBCIs, will require a number of technological advances prior to widespread use. But more importantly, they will raise a variety of social, ethical, and legal concerns. And they actually have an image here where they have an actuator. It looks like a little robot arm thingy. That looks cool. And then you got the things that you put in the brain. Oh, that's neat. That's pretty cool. I like that. But it's a schematic here that demonstrates the steps required for eBCI operation. EEG sensors acquire electrical signals from the brain, which are processed and outputted to control external devices. Though it is difficult to understand exactly what a user experiences when operating an external device with an EBCI, a few things are certain. For one, EBCIs can communicate both ways. This allows the person to control electronics, which is useful for medical patients that need help controlling wheelchairs, for example, but also potentially changes the way the brain functions. For some of these patients, these devices become such an integrated part of themselves that they refuse to have them removed at the end of clinical trial, said Riley Green, one of the authors. It has become increasingly evident that neurotechnologies have the potential to profoundly shape our own human experience and sense of self. Aside from these potentially bleak mental and... How are they bleak? Did you just take a black pill before you wrote this article? Aside from these potential bleak mental and physiological side effects, intellectual property concerns are also an issue and may allow private companies that develop EBCI technologies to own users' neural data. Okay, well, yeah, we saw that coming. It's called cyberpunk. Hello? This is particularly worrisome, since neural data is often considered to be the most intimate and private information that could be associated with any given user, said Roberto Portiolara, somebody who has never heard of cyberpunk in their life. This is mainly because, apart from its diagnostic value, EEG data could be used to infer emotional and cognitive states, which would provide unparalleled insight into user intentions, preferences, and emotions. And? Look, okay. If they see me, oh, this guy wants some hookers. Well, let's, and like, I don't know, man. Like, all of a sudden they just appear in my brain or something. Like, I don't know. I'm down for that. And they're like, they got like sponsor tags on them. One says, Lowe's. One says Home Depot. For some odd reason, they're all wearing construction stuff because they're promoting, like, I don't know, handyman shit or handy woman, I don't know, stuff like that. It's like, yeah, but they're still hookers. They're company-sponsored hookers, but they're hookers. As the availability of these platforms increases past medical treatment, disparities in access to these technologies may exacerbate existing social inequalities. For example, EBCIs can be used for cognitive enhancement and cause extreme imbalances in academic or professional successes and educational advancements. This bleak panorama brings forth an interesting dilemma about the role of policymakers in BCI commercialization, Green said. Should regulatory bodies intervene to prevent misuse and unequal access to neurotech? Should society follow instead the path taken by previous innovations, such as the internet or the smartphone, which originally targeted niche markets but are now commercialized on a global scale? She calls on global policymakers, neuroscientists, manufacturers, and potential users of these technologies to begin having these conversations early and collaborate to produce answers to these difficult moral questions. Despite the potential risks, the ability to integrate the sophistication of the human mind with the capabilities of modern technology constitutes an unprecedented scientific achievement, which is beginning to challenge our own preconceptions of what it means to be human, Green said. Well, again, if, you know, like, oh, this guy, we're gonna get you these robot waifu... 2B, which I'm going to be playing Nier Automata soon, so I'll know more about that game and won't just be able to reference it from meme culture or anything. I'll actually have background information. Just let me get through my survival horror binge first, folks. Just please. Anyway, the situation here is like, yeah, like, what is it, Square? Is it Square that owns that series? Where it's like, oh, we see you want to have sex with 2B. Well, here is 2B in your head. Look, I'm not going to have a problem with that. Bleak, cyborg, future. If I'm fucking 2B in my head or, you know, whatever else, they have the 2B butt controllers now, by the way. You guys got to check those out. They're fucking hilarious as hell. They're on pre-order, but they look fucking crazy. It's literally 2B's butt in a thong, and it's like, the controller is a booty. Like, I'm serious. It is. The controller is a booty. 2B has this big butt, and then A1 has, like, a little bit of a smaller butt. But I think a lot of people are gonna fucking buy that controller just because of that booty. I don't know how much it's gonna cost, though. But, Oh, and when you turn it over, it actually has, like, the front part, too. Like, yeah, it's the full thong. The back of the controller is her, like, vagina and stuff. Yeah, it's real. It's not meant to be a sex toy, folks. I mean, it's literally not meant to be, but whatever. Anyway, yeah, why not? If a company's like, yeah, we're gonna make it so you can fuck 2B in your head and check out Nier Automata 2 or 3 or whatever it would be on. Yeah, I'll fucking do it. That's fine. I'll play the game too. It's like, you know what I'll do? I'll go on there and say, ladies and gentlemen, I want to promote Nier Automata 3. And I also want to promote the fact that if you are feeling lonely, with your BCI, Square has made a new thing that you can actually have intimate sex with 2B inside of your head sphere. All you gotta do is just put the word out to Square. Their people will get to you, and you'll basically be able to interface with her in your head. And it's for promotion for their game. So, you know, check it out. You might like it. It might be fun. You might enjoy it. Everything is scripted pretty well. I think you'll enjoy the experience. I can't see the issue, folks. Can't see the problem. I'd be promoting the hooker robot, and I'd be promoting the game. So there you go. Okay. Now that was not as bad as I thought it was gonna be.